Well, when Rich asked me what the topic of my talk would be, I sort of remembered, you know, Sylvia Boorstin likes to say there's really only one Dharma talk. You know, as soon as you touch the Dharma, you get it all. And so when people ask me, I usually say, well, I'm doing that one. But he wasn't satisfied with that. So I said, well, I'll do something about the middle path. The middle path is the way of practice and living that the Buddha pointed to. And yet it's not explicated as much as it should be. And so I want to talk a little bit about the path and its role in the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. I teach about dissatisfaction with life and the end of that dissatisfaction. And the middle path is his way of living without dissatisfaction. So I want to go through that, but first I want to say something about the word path. Because path is a metaphor that carries some baggage that you might not notice right off. So for example, the word path could be a path going somewhere. And this is the way people often understand it, that maybe the middle path is going somewhere. And people will say, the path to the Grand Canyon is not the Grand Canyon, and the path to Nirvana is not Nirvana. And that is not uncommon, an uncommon way to think of what the middle path is about. But it's in a way, it sort of trivializes the path. The path is just something you get on to get to the end, and you move right along. But you could have a path that was circular. Imagine circumambulating a stupa or a sacred mountain. Okay. In which case, getting on the path and staying on the path is the point. It's not going anywhere, but staying on the path and is the attainment. And so I tend to think of the middle path more like that. Just being able to live the middle path is the attainment. And the middle path, the Buddha is very, it was clear in the sutta that is labeled the first sermon. The Buddha describes the middle path. He said, and what is the middle way that's realized that by the Tathagata? That leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, and to unbinding. It's precisely the Noble Eightfold Path. Noble Eightfold Path. It's the fourth of the what we call the Four Noble Truths. And that's really where the action is. The first of the Noble Truths are the truths. I don't like the word truth, because it sounds like fact. And in fact, the label Noble Truths is a label that was appended a bit later. There are many scholars now who don't think the Buddha actually called them Noble Truths. Most of the references to this pattern in the canon don't include the label Noble Truths at all. The Buddha will say, such is suffering, such the origin of suffering, such the cessation of suffering, and such the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So it's important, if you're going to take a look at the middle path, what I'm going to do is locate the Eightfold Path in the context of the four truths. I'll call them truths. On the tandat, I call them teachings, because you just can't write the word truth. And so understanding its position in the Buddha's teaching is really important. So let's start with this chart that I made up, because I know that some of you have, if it's after work and you don't get a vision of a PowerPoint display, you know what I mean? So here's my PowerPoint of the Buddha's. This is how the Buddha would have presented his insight if he'd lived 2,500 years later. He would be up on the wall looking like this. So the four truths, I'll just call them the truths, are listed, are the four columns here. And the Buddha's, the first two are about dukkha, and the last two are about the cessation of dukkha. Dukkha is the word that the Buddha used to describe the whole range of experiences we have to which we react with aversion and frustration and anger and fear. It's all the negative, no, I don't want that. Everything that's unacceptable, everything that's unsatisfactory about life. When you experience something that's unsatisfactory, dukkha. How do you know when you're experiencing something unsatisfactory? That's an interesting, because sometimes that ambiance of dissatisfaction, Richard Farina had a book in the 60s called Been Down So Long It Looks Like Up To Me. You know, it's like you're sitting in a room and the air conditioner goes off and you hadn't been aware that it was on. You know what I mean? So there's that ambience of dukkha. There was a cartoon in the New Yorker, oh my gosh, it must have been 50 years ago, where it had two Indian ascetics sleeping on beds of nails. And one of them said to the other, I fell out of bed last night, it was wonderful. So we often don't notice dukkha. But the biggest measure is complaint. A complaint of any kind. Dissatisfaction is basically what it's measuring. The Buddha, in the first sermon, he identified, he didn't define dukkha, sometimes it's called, you know, the truth of dukkha. He didn't define it. The text reads, the noble truth of suffering, birth, and here's the list, he just lists the experiences that we would probably, birth, aging, sickness, death, pain, sorrow, distress, lamentation, despair, not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, losing what you cherish. Now some people may think, birth. But Mark Twain said once, he said, I always wonder why people rejoice at births and despair at deaths, grieve at deaths. He said, I guess it's because they're not the parties involved. And, you know, the story is that we all started with no. So these are all unpleasant. Basically, if you look at these experiences, they're all painful or unpleasant, just on the surface. The Buddha said what we are supposed to do is understand dukkha, understand the unsatisfactory elements of our life. Well, these things in and of themselves are just unpleasant. What makes them unsatisfactory is what's contained in the second truth, or described in the second truth. It identifies the condition that gives rise to dukkha, that turns an unpleasant, just unpleasantness, into unsatisfactoriness. And this is in the yellow box is the text from the sutta, craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, craving for non-becoming. I don't like the word craving, translating it, and maybe I'll make that clear in a minute. But there are three kinds of, the word the Buddha used was tanha, and it actually translates most literally as thirst, because that's our subjective experience of the urgency of wanting and not wanting, and believing, our greed, hatred, and delusion. Tanha, the three kinds, kamatanha, and vibhava tanha, they're the built-in dispositions in us to want our experience pleasant. And to resist and try to get rid of the experience that's painful and unpleasant. Anybody not work that way? I mean, right. And then bhava tanha is translated usually as becoming. Bhava, to become. And I interpret it, I actually interpret the Buddha's vision as the subjective experience of our evolutionary inheritance in terms of our dispositions to survive and reproduce, to project ourselves into the world, to live forever or die trying. You know? Isn't that sort of, you know, we're sort of there? And we've got this incredibly powerful brain that enables us to predict. It's really what our big skill is, to be able to predict what's going to happen. I can outthink my dog, my poor dog, but she, you know, she thinks she's going to get away with something, but, you know, if you're a step or two ahead of your dog, you're always going to beat your dog. But she doesn't have a forehead. Have you ever noticed dogs? It just goes right from the top of the eyes back. No ability to do the kind of calculation that this job might lend more stability and possibility for more advance. I mean, to make those kinds of calculations about every aspect of our lives as we advance. We want to advance our agenda. So I think of Tanha as describing the subjective experience of the evolutionary imperative that we come with. And I see the Dharma often in terms of neuroscience and evolutionary biology. And I guess Rick Hansen is, Rick Maddock, who's in the Davis group, teaches the neuroscience part a lot. And I found it incredibly helpful. But if unpleasant experience, all the stuff in this first list, meets up with a disposition that doesn't like the stuff in the first list, you get dukkha. Because we're disposed to be aversive. And what we add to what's already unpleasant. Actually, the second truth is that we usually make things worse. First truth, you know, in prison, I work in the mental health wing, and in contexts where I can't talk about the Buddha, the Dharma, or the Sangha. So I sort of have translated some of the concepts into street language, and in the language of the street, the first noble truth is shit happens. I mean, look at that list. Anybody missed out on that? Shit, right? It happens. Second truth, we usually make it worse. How much worse? You know, how much worse can you imagine? Well, suppose, just examples abound, but one that just showed up for me recently was a friend who went to the doctor with a headache, and the doctor said, "I don't like this. We think we need to get some x-rays to rule out a brain tumor." Well, what do you think is going on in that person's mind while waiting for the test? Dukkha. You know, and it's not just the headache. The headache is already there. But the anguish, that's the dukkha. No, that's what we had. I have a friend who was at work Friday. Oh, by the way, it turned out allergies. Yeah. So, you know, that doesn't freak you out quite so much, right? Not so much dukkha, actually. You know. A friend of mine was working Friday late in the afternoon, and her boss came by at about 4 o'clock, came to her little cubicle and said, "Monday morning, first thing, we got to talk." How was her weekend? Dukkha. Dukkha is the add-on. It's the stuff we add on. It's the stories we tell ourselves. It's the expectations that we set ourselves up with. The third truth, the Buddha said, the dissolution of dukkha. So dukkha is a composite experience. It's not just pain. It's not just, I just look at that list and they jump right out. It's not like sickness. It's sickness plus the aversive response and what goes on in the mind, and the body reacts to whatever is in the mind. The body feels the feeling of the thoughts in the mind. Buddha says the task here at the bottom, this is his description in that first sermon, abandon tanha, which is that's a tall order. Because if tanha is really our evolutionary inheritance to survive and reproduce, he's telling us, get over it. It's a high bar. On the other hand, he does say, nothing more for me in this world. Nothing more to do. So the third truth, the dissolution of dukkha, the word nirodha, sometimes translated as cessation, I think of it as evaporation sometimes, because dukkha is that composite thing. If you take the craving out, all you're left with is the shit. Pain, unpleasantness, but without ginning it up with our own reactive responses, greed, hatred, and of course it's the delusion that sets us up for it in the first place. Greed, hatred, and delusion. So here's the text in that yellow box, the text on the cessation. It's the remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and not letting go of that very tanha, or craving, that disposition, the tendency, the proclivity on our part to respond to unpleasantness with aversion and with the vision of potential pleasure, success, advancement, with grasping. You know, Bhikkhu Bodhi says we spend all our time running around trying to make things more pleasant, get rid of the unpleasant, and trying to figure out how it all relates to me. So the dissolution of dukkha comes with the abandonment of tanha and its products. That's how I refer to greed, hatred, and delusion. And so the middle path is the eightfold path. It's the elements of the fourth truth, and that's, I'm just going to read through. It's the path of cessation, and again, I'm thinking of this as more of a circular kind of thing. Realizing the path, living the path, is the trick. It's not, you know. Well, we'll get to some of it. We'll get to all eight. But the fourth teaching points to the way of living without dukkha. And I'll just read through it. Sama ditti, the word sama we'll talk about in a minute. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. First thing I'd like to say about this is that it's not a one-fold path. I mean, I know it looks like an eightfold path on the paper, but how much of our work is engaging anything but the meditative side? You know, we often treat it as a one-fold path, and we skip right through. Right view? Ah, anicca, dukkha, anatta. Got that. Right intention? Oh, yeah. Right speech? Yeah, I didn't lie today. And right action? I didn't kill anybody. Right livelihood. Okay, I'm good to go. Right? But in Davis, Davis group, we think of it as the eightfold basketball. So the eightfold basketball is like this. It's a sphere. It's brown. It's about 15 inches across. Made of rubber, got dimples on it. Full of compressed air. Weighs a couple pounds. Got black stripes around it. And it's about 15 inches across. That's about 8. But you can't play basketball with just the brown. Right? It's the whole thing. The Eightfold Path is a unit that we're looking at. It's a way of being that the Buddha is describing from several different perspectives. For first thing he says is that right view is the first. Right view is the most important. Do I need to read the citation, or you just trust me that it's... Right view is the first. One of right view, he said, will have right intention, right speech, right action, etc. And one of wrong view will be just the opposite. Actually, my understanding is that what I'm working on cultivating is my understanding. Because understanding dispels the delusion. Let me say something about sama, the word sama. It's translated most commonly as right, because it's one word in Pali, and we like to translate one word with one word. So you get right view, right speech, right, and it implies like wrong view. I actually think the opposite of right view is delusion, not wrong view. But I'll say something about that in a minute. But some people I know at Spirit Rock, they have on the prayer wheel when you go into the retreat center, they call it wise view, wise, you know, intention. Some people use skillful or wholesome. But I just want to get away from the one word translation. What the word means is that it's appropriate for abandoning tanha. The elements on the Eightfold Path exist on the Eightfold Path as elements of the Eightfold Path because they provide a method, provide part of the response that enables us to eliminate tanha, not taking the bait of the objects of greed and aversion. Right view is classically right understanding. Is classically understood as anicca, dukkha, anatta. Right? Impermanence, anicca, dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, anatta, which is emptiness, not self. We'll get through that one pretty quick. And that's people say, well, yeah, okay, I got it. Everything's impermanent. Yep, check. Dukkha, yep. Anatta, sort of whatever that means. Check. We say, yeah, I know impermanence. Oh, no, I lost my favorite pen. Impermanence. Oh, my job. I thought I was with that job forever. Broke my favorite mug. Things happen. We go, yeah. So impermanence, knowing about impermanence, not the same thing as living with a constant awareness of the impermanent nature of what's happening. We think things should be stable. Like Florida Keys. It's going to be different. Dukkha. We expect, how do we navigate our lives? We try to get what we think will make us happy, what we think will be pleasant, what we think won't be unpleasant. We do what we do because we're expecting satisfaction, not because we're just taking a flyer. It's not like buying we commit to things because we think they'll be satisfying. Buddha said dukkha is inherent unsatisfactoriness because of impermanence. Even if it turns out the way you like it, it's downhill from there. Unsatisfactoriness. And we live in a delusional state that expects to be satisfied. And then when we don't, what happens when we don't get what we want? We get a little testy. Aversion. Vibhava tanha kicks in and we get greed or anger, ill will. What is full understanding? I think this is there's a couple of places here where the Buddha says this, which is just amazing to me when I stumbled across it. And what is full understanding? An ending of desire, an ending of hatred, an ending of delusion. This is full understanding. Yeah, that's pretty good. That's in the Samyutta Nikaya. And the Majjhima says, him I call deluded, who has not abandoned the taints that defile, bring renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging, and death. The taints, greed, hatred, and delusion, or kamatanha, bhavatanha, vibhavatanha. Him I call undiluted, who has abandoned the taints that defile. For it is with the abandoning of the taints that one becomes undiluted. So, those of us tonight who are not ready to say, I've conquered the taints, Buddha's saying, we're deluded. And probably, you know, it probably is... back to that thing about complaints. The world is the way it is. Things are the way they are. If we have a problem with them, a complaint, justified or not, however you justify, but justified or not, if we have a dispute, a complaint, well, that's us. It's not the world. The world just is. And what we bring, when we bring complaint to the table, dukkha, the living, actually living free of complaint, a complaint-free life would be without wanting it different, without needing it different. It's a tall order, but it's one way of understanding what the Buddha was pointing at. Can we live without complaint? We can address anything that's present. And we are, you know, we're to engage it, certainly. But the delusion is interesting. And it's part of the anatta part, the not-self part, the emptiness part. The nature of our delusion is we believe our thoughts. And we're designed to believe our thoughts. Nothing wrong with believing our thoughts, you know. Nothing wrong with believing our thoughts. We need to depend on them. In a pinch, you know, for 150,000 years we evolved in groups of 75 people or so, and we survive better if we make some mistakes. So you see a brown shape behind some trees, and if you're afraid it's a lion and you run and it's really a rock, no harm, no foul. Mm-hmm. But if you see a brown shape behind the leaves and you say, rock, and it's a lion, so it's better for you to make a mistake all the time, or most of the time. Your chances of survival are better. That doesn't say that we got to get it right. We just have to get it so that we stay alive. So the map of the world that we've crafted isn't necessarily, well, just look at all these colors. Everybody, you know, you see colors here, right? There are no colors. Colors out there in the world, these things really aren't that color. This all happens in your neurology. Sugar isn't sweet. It's just a pile of chemicals. Sweet is what happens in your mouth, on your tongue. That chemical on your tongue, it's an interactive thing. So we tend to believe our thinking. What else do we rely on? But the Buddha was not so easy with that. I'll just read a couple of these. These are really fun. Cosmologist comes to the Buddha. Then a Brahmin who was a cosmologist approached the Blessed One and said to him, how is it, Master Gautama, does all exist? All exists. This Brahman is the oldest cosmology. Then Master Gautama, does all not exist? All does not exist. This Brahman is the second cosmology. How is it, Master Gautama, is it all a unity? All is a unity, all is one. This Brahman is the third cosmology. And then Master Gautama, is it all a plurality? It starts to remind me of Socrates, and that, you know, he always says. And the Buddha says, all is a plurality, this Brahman is the fourth cosmology. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata, that's how the Buddha referred to himself, the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma by the middle. He doesn't make any metaphysical affirmations at all. I like this one. This one sounds a little crazy. And the Venerable Kacchanagata approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down on one side and said to him, Venerable Sir, it is said, right view, right view. In what way, Venerable Sir, is there right view? The Buddha says, this world, Kacchana, for the most part, depends upon a duality, upon the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence. But for one who sees the origin of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there's no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. And for one who sees the cessation of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there's no notion of existence in regard to the world. All exists, this is one extreme. All does not exist, this is the second extreme. Or this is, or it isn't. In Zen, they hold up a pen or something and they say, what is this? Call it a pen, I'll hit you with it. Say it's not a pen, I'll hit you with it. What is it? Right? That's why I practice in the Theravadan tradition. I'm a coward. All exists, or it exists, anything exists, this is one extreme, nothing exists, this is the second extreme. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the teacher, the Tathagata, teaches the Dharma by the middle. It's interesting. He says, I teach a Dharma that doesn't contend with anyone, that doesn't dispute with anyone, that doesn't quarrel with anyone in the world. That's right view. It's a koan. It's a vision to hold and to compare when we assert, the Dharma is this, the Dharma is that. It's a breath mint, it's a candy mint. And then there's the question of self, anatta, which is the third of these characteristics. The wanderer Vajragota went to the Buddha and on arrival exchanged views, and as he was sitting there he said, Venerable Gautama, is there a self? When this was said, the Blessed One was silent. Then is there no self? A second time the Blessed One was silent. Then Vajragota, the wanderer, got up from his seat and left. Not long afterwards, Ananda said to the Blessed One, why, Lord, did the Blessed One not answer when asked a question by Vajragota, the wanderer? The Buddha says, Ananda, if being asked by the wanderer if there was a self, if I were to answer that there was a self, this would be conforming to those Brahmins and contemplatives who are exponents of eternalism, the view that there is something there. If I said there was no self, that would conform to those Brahmins and contemplatives who are exponents of annihilationism. There's the idea that there's nothing, but there's something here. It's just not what we think. I mean, there is. We've got, you know... experience is happening, but it's not what we think. because the Tathagata does not conceive of anything. He doesn't cling to anything in the world. Not clinging, he is not agitated. Being unagitated, he personally attains nibbana. He understands, destroyed his birth, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, and there is no more for this state of being. It's describing having abandoned that evolutionary imperative. It's a tall bar. It's a high bar. So right view is somewhere between the delusion and the assumption of reality, and we're sort of stuck there. We need our maps of the world to live. But as soon as we assume that they're true and representative of the way things are, well, then we get testy when somebody says no. We get cranky when our view is not upheld. Quarrels and disputes. So it's the understanding, the narrative, the story, the perception that enables us to live without suffering, that enables us to live without taking the bait. Basically, it's a matter, we all have our map of the world and our expectation of how things should be. And when things don't go the way I expect them to, much less the way I want them to, I say to myself, what did I expect? What did I expect? Did I think that I really knew what was going on? Well, yeah. That's why you get cranky. And you know what the story is behind, what happens? I'm right and they're wrong. That's the story of anger is behind that. Just check that out. When you're angry with somebody, it's not, they're wrong. You don't get angry with inanimate objects like the weather. You don't get angry with the heat. You might not like it, but you don't go outside and scream at the heat. Well, if you're Lear. So let's, if we look at right intention and right effort, they're very much the same. Actually, these things are color-coded for ongoing discussion. The shapes are different. So right intention and right effort are very similar. Right effort is classically described as cultivating the wholesome. Well, that would be sama, right? Cultivating that which enables us to live without dukkha. Cultivating the wholesome, sustaining the wholesome that's present, abandoning the unwholesome, right? And keeping the unwholesome that hasn't arisen from arising. That's the and that's basically, path of cultivation and the path of renunciation. They're two paths. Same with right intention. Right intention is classically taught as renunciation. Abandonment of tanha. Abandonment of craving. But you don't abandon the craving without abandoning the objects of craving. So when we work with it, look to the things you want and the things you don't want. And then look underneath, watch the feeling you have when you think about what you want and what you don't want. The body always responds to what's in your mind, to what's going on in your mind, which is why when you put your mind in your breath, mind calms. But if your mind is on the jerk at work who just wants, body gets tight when you think about that. And then you think about, oh, my dog, how cute, so furry, so and your body relaxes. Well, my body does. Maybe you don't like dogs, so what can I say? So renunciation, abandonment of the craving. It's going to arise. Greed, aversion, going to arise. Sometimes we can. One of the things that I've been teaching the men in prison. When you go into the doctor's office and the doctor says, on a scale of 1 to 10, how's your pain? You can do that, right? Basically, what you're doing is you're setting up a concept, the whole range of pain that you can imagine, and you're comparing your experience on that. But you can also, how much do you want something? On a scale of 1 to 10, how important, how much do you want that Tesla S? Or the vanilla Ben & Jerry's? And you know, we do this. Watch yourself. This is kind of fun. If you ever go into a Starbucks or a pizza or someplace where there's pastries and coffee, I was in line behind this woman. She was watching, looking in the pastry cabinet, and I thought, I wonder what's going on in her mind. Oh, I know what's going on. You look at the cinnamon roll and you do a flash take on what it's going to feel like, taste like, and then you look at the scone and you say, well, less calories, and it's all calculated in, but you're doing a little taste test in your mind, you know. And you can do it quick. You just go from one to the other. Just have, and then you make your choice, the one that's going to be satisfy most of the conditions. So there's the path of cultivation. Also, right intention. We practice metta. We practice mindfulness. We want to cultivate the paramis, the perfections. So we got the path of cultivation, the path of renunciation. But you know, in practice, it happens fast. It happens really fast. I think of it as like a tightrope walker. You walk on the tightrope and you're doing this. When your body leans to the left, you do the balance to the right. When your body leans to the right, you do the balance to the left. You're not thinking about that. It's all unconscious. You know, it's like Roger Federer hitting a return, you know, of a ball coming at him 110 miles an hour. He doesn't have a chance to say, you lift the racket, you twist the wrist. I mean, he's thinking on a totally different, this is all just reflex. So the Dharma ultimately should be reflex, should be automatic pilot. Like riding a bike. You know how to ride a bike. You can't explain how to ride a bike. The only way you can prove you know how to ride a bike is get on a bike and ride it. You can't convince anybody by talking. Same with the Dharma. Right intention. So the path, there's the middle path, is the path cultivate, renounce. Cultivate, renounce. Depending on what the conditions are. If you're desiring something, you don't want to cultivate the desire. You want to step back for up and observe it. Maybe there's nothing wrong. Go forward with it. But just to be mindful. We'll talk about the mindfulness in a minute. So that the middle path here is the path of both, depending on the circumstances. And then the heart of the path, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, this is the reward of the path. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. This is, in a way, the goal of practice, to live without dukkha, right? You know? Right speech, right action, right livelihood. Often it gets translated quickly into precepts, and then we move right on. And the precepts, you know, don't kill, don't steal, don't engage in harmful sexuality, don't lie and heaven forfend, no drugs or alcohol. But really, that's, you know, there's a story where the Buddha gets, you know, is approached by a Brahmin who says, the highest ethical behavior is not killing. That just runs through the precepts. And the Buddha says, a stupid baby boy lying on his back doesn't do any of those things. So you're saying the highest ethical standard is fulfilled by a stupid baby boy lying on his back? So we say, okay, don't kill. Almost as if it's a rule. I mean, if you see Adam Lanza heading into the Sandy Hook schoolyard with heavy weaponry, and you know that he's going to blow away a bunch of children, do you say, well, I can't do anything? Oh, I seem to have. If you have a weapon, do you stop him? Or do you say, I mean, there's. Sometimes it's the middle path. It's not a straight rule. Don't steal. Well, how about don't take what's not freely given? Really, you know, it's not, we think of it as a rule. But the Buddha says the middle path. Would you take a gun from a child? Give me the gun. No. You're going to take it? Not freely given. Keys from a drunk? Car keys from a drunk? Not freely given. But what's the ethical thing to do? The Nazis knock on the door and ask if Anne Frank is here. Do you say, what do you mean by is? Remember how that worked for Bill Clinton? Pretty good, huh? You know, but there are people, there are teachers who will tell you that you have to finesse that question. I think you lie as convincingly as you possibly can. Mm-hmm. What's so it's not don't speak falsely. It's not a rule like that. It's a tool for inquiry. And really the standard for speech, action, and livelihood is don't make it worse. Whatever is going on, there's going to be some unsatisfactoriness in there. And the trick is not to make it worse. And being able to live that way, the middle path in speech, action, livelihood, there's no right speech and wrong speech. There's speech that makes it worse and speech that may ease the way. And samasati and samasamadhi, you know, they're a polarity. Ajahn Chah says meditation is like this pen. This end, mindfulness, this end, concentration. So it's the middle path. You can't get mindful if you don't have any steadiness of mind. You can't get steadiness of mind if you're not aware of when the mind's drifting. And I actually think that samasati is not the same thing as satipatthana. There's a lot of talk that that's the foundations of mindfulness. The four foundations of mindfulness is the essence of right mindfulness. But mindfulness in this case is the mindfulness that enables us to abandon tanha, to live without suffering. So it's not mindfulness of our breathing. That's like finger exercises. It's not knowing. We need to monitor our ongoing intentions moment by moment. We need to maintain mindfulness, stable mindfulness, concentrated, focused, mindful attention all the time. Monitoring the play of intentions. Get rid of this, want more of that, more of that, more of that, and less of that. Oh no, none of that. That's going on all the time. We just don't notice it because we're lost in the thought dreams that we use to figure our way through the world. Nothing wrong with that. We're designed to do that. We're designed by, dare I say, our creator, natural selection. No? We are cultured by natural selection. You know, to be in a particular way that helps us survive and project ourselves into the future. So we want to be watching that. Can we watch when desire starts to arise? And it's not that we're supposed to abandon desire particularly. There's a great place in the suttas where Vajragota asks the Buddha, oh, your monks and nuns are pretty cool. They seem to get it. But do you have any lay followers, you know, who are living your teaching? And the Buddha says, any? I said, not only any. I've got hundreds, thousands of lay people who are living the teacher's dispensation independent. They know for themselves what their task is. They're working on it themselves. And he said, and one of their qualities is they enjoy sensual pleasures. You know, nothing wrong with the creme brulee. I mean, unless it's sort of rancid. But nothing wrong in principle. Because principle is not the middle way. The middle way is the way of not making things worse, and it's taking in the context and your conditioning and coming up with speech, action, livelihood. The middle path is an active living path. It's a way of being that engages everything. Sometimes I think the notion of engaged Buddhism suggests that the middle path is not enough. But I think if you're living the middle path or working on cultivating the middle path, you're engaged. Cultivate. That's interesting that the Buddha uses that term. What is the task? It's to cultivate this path, this Eightfold Path. And there's an interesting word. I started with a thought about the word path. I think about the word cultivate. It's an agricultural metaphor. The Buddha lived in an agricultural time. You don't actually make the plant grow. You create the conditions for the plant to grow. The Buddha was very concerned with artisanship. A lot of times he would talk about, as a fletcher shapes the arrow, a woodworker shapes the wood, a water channel maker channels the water. So the wise cultivate themselves. The language of artisanship is a language of art and mastery and practice. So, and he says there are two conditions which give rise to right view, and from right view come all the remaining elements. Right view being the middle path between the practical delusion that we live with, can't live without it, but the knowledge that it's delusion. You guys know who Dogen was? He was a Zen master who founded the Soto Zen Center about the 12th century, I think. He said, enlightenment is only enlightenment about delusion. And delusion is delusion about enlightenment. So there are two conditions that give rise to right view, which is the understanding that doesn't contend with anyone, that's balanced between delusion and the practical necessities. There are two conditions for the arising of right view: the voice of another and wise attention. Teaching and practice, listening, studying, and practice. So the middle path is a path of study and practice. It's a middle path. So the guidance for me, non-dispute, non-quarrel, look for those in your practice. Let me just pause for a minute and see how this is going down. What do you think? Any questions, comments, thoughts, complaints? Please.
Well, early in this discussion, or teaching, mm-hmm. you talked about contending with someone or something.
Mm-hmm.
And at first didn't seem like that was probably not something we wanted to do.
It didn't seem like something you wanted to do?
We should be doing. But then later you talked about the middle path and ethical considerations and, for instance, the Anne Frank. Mm-hmm. So, and I agreed with your discussion about those ethical considerations, but so if there's something unjust, should we not contend with it?
Well, there's different ways of addressing what's unjust. You can you can address it with anger, aversion, complaint, or you can address the suffering that the injustice is about, and there's plenty of it around. I was listening to something on NPR recently, and there was the Dukkha Channel. That's what Jack Kornfield called it. Jack has a friend who calls it the Dukkha Channel. And it was a story about a young Asian woman who changed, she was an actress, and she changed her name from Wong to Bennett in order to get work. And the question is, shouldn't you be standing up for and fighting? And I thought, you know, the middle path is a dance. It's a dance that we navigate on our own. And maybe that's too much. Maybe that's too big a step. In that situation, each of us has to make the judgment call. And we will, of course. But I would say that when we encounter injustice, it's what we're looking at as suffering. Now, one of the things that happens is that we respond. I mean, we are still living in the heaven realms. These are pretty good. We don't have a hurricane going. We don't have floods going. The wildfires are still somewhere else. You know. But we've got the soundtrack from hell. And what do we respond to? The soundtrack. Everybody in this room is awash in dukkha. Of one form or another. And yet, anger makes us feel righteous, feeds our ego strength. Compassion doesn't. And compassion can go directly to the people we encounter who are suffering. So I think it's interesting that we when we think of injustice, we don't look to the people that we're living with and encountering. We look to the social policy. The Buddha was not particularly into social policy. So I would say engage injustice where you can, but if it's on TV, you know, anger, righteous anger is only, you know, strengthening selfing. I'm right, they're wrong. That story is the story behind anger. Yeah?
Well, I agree to a point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Act with compassion towards those who are suffering.
Yeah.
Do what you can to relieve that suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But if the root cause of suffering is some policy, some legislation regarding
mm-hmm.
that, you can do more than just be angry about that. There are things you can take actions to try
sure.
to address.
And we all have our idea about how things should be. And we're all going to act as we see fit based on our understanding. But it may not be the Dharma. Nothing wrong with taking action, you know, political action, engaged, whatever. But when the Buddha says, I teach a teaching that does not contend with anyone, that doesn't quarrel with anyone, if you can take that on without dispute and quarrel, there's a Dharma model for me anyway. Yeah?
So what I notice more and more is that this is an interaction, internal suffering, the external suffering, and the more I pay attention to the feelings in the body around things like anger and my belief that things need to be different, and I do this in my personal relations a lot. I put it over there when it's really, I don't like housework, but my husband's not helping enough. You know, I mean, that kind of thing. But what I'm noticing more and more is the discomfort in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So even that's a clue. I'm contending with myself.
Well, that's actually, there's
you know,
a lot of that.
But with that idea.
Yeah. And you can feel it in the body.
You can feel it in the body.
And that's why for the Buddha, mindfulness of the body was so important. Not just the breathing, but the whole body. There's a separate sutta on mindfulness of the body and a separate sutta on mindfulness of breathing.
And I'm noticing that things like compassion, there's a pain, a hurt, a heart feeling in the body.
Yeah.
But it feels very different than the clench and the anguish of that anger when you see that thing that you need to stop that person or what. Somehow there's just a different thing, and I've really been kind of exploring that feeling of allowing that hurt in. Feels almost more instructive than...
There's a word in Pali, it's anukampa, and it means the quivering of the heart in the presence of suffering.
It's very hard to stay there sometimes.
It's hard to stay there because we don't want to cry.
Mm-hmm.
And the world is just crushingly sad. And we don't want that. We don't want to feel that. That's vulnerable and doesn't make for a big survival story, you know. So we muscle right through it. We do almost anything to not feel that kind of sadness. And when there's no way out, we collapse.
And yet you can get. I mean, when you can share that with a person.
Yeah.
It's so much, it's hard to describe, but it feels wholesome, something, whatever that is,
yeah.
Much better than the...
Well, we navigate by feel, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that pleasant, unpleasant business, mm-hmm. we always spend our time trying to feel just a little better, maybe a lot better, certainly not worse. We navigate by feeling. This would be better, and then we've got reasons for it.
Mm-hmm.
So the middle path is a dance. You know? It's the process of monitoring ourselves and watching so that we can watch the impulses, the desires arise and either move on or sweep us along with it. One more, yeah.
I at times have felt like I was really getting what you were saying, and overall I do feel like it. But in the term middle, it's the only term that's relative on the sheet. It's
mm-hmm.
middle between something and something else. And I'm trying to just pinpoint the something and the something else, but
for each element it's different. For right view it's between delusion and certainty. Okay, so we're seeing the delusion. It's the certainty of delusion versus seeing the delusion. Okay, for right intention and right effort, it's the middle between the cultivation path of cultivation and the path of renunciation. For right speech, right action, right livelihood, it's not making things worse. You've got the guidelines, but it's not rule-based. You're not following a rule, do this or don't do that. It's whatever in the particular situation will not make things worse. It's your experience, you know? And the samasati, samasamadhi, these are states of, you know, cultivate the mind. The Buddha said, this is my translation of 183 in the Dhammapada, don't make things worse. Ease the way for people if you can. And cultivate the mind so you can figure out how to do that. Samasati, samasamadhi. We can do jhana practice. These are finger exercises. In life, it's the sati, samadhi that enables us to live without suffering, to abandon the tanha. So it's a balance between the two. Thank you guys for your attention.